That lines Iran calls for global nuclear disarmament, saying Israel's nuclear weapons pose a threat to peace and security of the region and beyond. Jordan fully reopens its main border crossing with Syria after a decade and is set to resume flights to its neighboring country next Sunday. Also, former Foreign Minister Fumio Kishida becomes Japan's new Prime Minister as he won a race to lead the nation's ruling party. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour. Iran's deputy foreign minister has called for global nuclear disarmament, saying it's the responsibility of all governments to eliminate the threats of these weapons. Reza Najafi made the remarks in the U.S. city of New York during a United Nations General Assembly meeting on the International Day for the Total Elimination of Nuclear Weapons. The Iranian diplomat said the Islamic Republic strongly rejects preservation, storage, proliferation, and development of nuclear weapons at global and regional levels. Najafi stressed the implementation of the 1995 UN resolution on the Middle East, which endorses a region free of nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction. The Iranian diplomat called Israel's nuclear weapons an obstacle to the UN resolution. Najafi said the regime poses a threat to peace and security in the region and beyond. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has appointed Peyman Jebeli as the new director of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting. In a message, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has thanked the services of outgoing IRIB director Abdul Ali Ali Askeri and wished success for Jebeli in his new post. Jebeli holds a PhD in culture and communication from Imam Sadegh University, has served in numerous positions in IRIB. The 55-year-old was appointed deputy director of IRIB World Service in August 2016. He has held other posts in the corporation, including IRIB Political Directorate and CEO of Press TV and Al Alam News Channels. During his tenure at IRIB World Service, Jebeli founded Iran Press News Agency as well as Al Alam Syria News Channel. He also established Husa Internet TV and Press TV in French while in office. Jebeli had also served as Iran's ambassador to Tunisia for 3 years. Well, let's listen to the latest comments coming from Dr. Peyman Jebeli as he has been appointed as the new director of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting.
This position and this very important social situation in the highest level requires that IRIB creates discourse and also uses all national capacities, especially the capacity of the young of young elites, which is in our program.
Well, those were the latest comments coming from Dr. Peyman Jebeli as leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has appointed Mr. Jebeli as the new director of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting. Moving on, Jordan has fully reopened its main border crossing with Syria in a step to restore extensive business ties with Damascus. The Nasib-Jabarb crossing was a transit route for hundreds of trucks a day before the Syria conflict started. In 2011, Jordan's state carrier Royal Jordanian will also resume flights to Syria next Sunday after a decade-long hiatus. Bilateral trade between Amman and Damascus amounted to over $1 billion a year before the start of the war. Jordan was a staunch supporter of militants fighting to topple the Syrian government. Our correspondent Muhammad Ali is joining us now from the Syrian capital, Damascus, with more on that story of Jordan and Syria reopening the main border crossing between the two countries and what looks like a full reestablishment of ties between Amman and Damascus. Muhammad, what do you have to share with us?
Just a couple of days after an official announcement from the Jordanian side that this border crossing will be opened, it did open, and both trucks carrying goods and also ordinary passengers started crossing that border crossing from Syria to Jordan and vice versa. Of course, this is very important for both countries, whether speaking socially or economically. Also, we have to point out that this step comes just a couple of days following a high-level ministerial meeting between both officials from both countries, several ministers of service sectors like the economy, water, and agriculture, visited Syrian officials visited Jordan and held meetings over there. And they agreed on enhancing partnerships in the sectors of energy, water, and agriculture. In the trade and industry fields, also, both sides agreed to exchange lists of priority commodities to enhance commercial exchange. They also overviewed the necessary procedures to reopen the Jordanian-Syrian free zone. They also discussed issues related to the water sector, and the two countries agreed, actually, to reactivate the Joint Water Committee to follow up on implementing a 1987 agreement and increased cooperation, of course, over there. They also reviewed cooperation in the energy and electricity fields and means to reactivate the Jordanian-Syrian electric connection line. In general, they discussed cooperation, reactivating cooperation in the main service sector between both countries. We also know that the Jordanian flights will resume operating to Damascus International Airport. This, of course, for the first time since 2012. We also heard from the United States welcoming this step, which means that there is a green light, perhaps, from the United States for the first time to an Arab country to reopen and reactivate such kinds of relations between any Arab country and Syria. Of course, we have to also confirm that this only comes after efforts from Jordan in the past couple of months to reestablish this kind of relations between Syria. It's a very important step for both countries, economically speaking, and we have to wait and see what will further happen. Will this step be taken by other Arab countries or not? But definitely it is very significant for both peoples and for both economies.
All right, thanks a lot. We're going to leave it there. Mohammed Ali, your correspondent, joining us from the Syrian capital, Damascus. Elsewhere, Yemeni officials have slammed as illegal a meeting in Iraq's Kurdistan region on normalizing ties with Israel. They also hailed the Iraqi government for decrying the conference. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more from the Yemeni capital.
Yemenis have condemned what the Iraqi government has described as an illegal meeting held in Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdistan region. The meeting demanded Baghdad join the so-called Abraham Accords and normalize ties with Israel.
We believe in the rights of the Palestinian people to liberate their land, and therefore we will stand against any attempt to normalize relations with Israel. The recent illegal meeting in the Iraqi city of Erbil is completely rejected. It's a desperate attempt after the failure of the so-called deal of the century. Palestine will be liberated and Israelis will be expelled.
Yemen's Prime Minister Abdulaziz bin Habtour slammed the meeting, saying it is an attempt to drag the free people of Iraq to normalize relations with the Israeli regime, adding those who have normalized ties with Israel are part of the Zionist project in the region.
The normalization meeting that was held in Erbil, Iraq, is an attempt to drag the Iraqi people into normalization with the Israeli enemy and for Iraq to become part of the Zionist project, as some Arab rulers did last year. But the conference failed and was rejected by all the free and resistance forces in Iraq because it is a betrayal of the Palestinian cause and the Islamic nation.
The so-called Abraham Accords is a U.S.-led Middle East initiative aimed at establishing diplomatic relations and full normalization between Arab countries and the Israeli regime. This agreement was signed by Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Morocco, and Sudan, and was welcomed by Israeli officials.
Yemenis have praised the Iraqi government's rejection of normalization of ties with Israel. They say the free people of the world will always support the Palestinian cause until the liberation of the occupied territories. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Japan's former foreign minister, Fumio Kishida, wins a ruling Liberal Democratic Party leadership race that sets him on course to become the next prime minister. Kishida managed to get 257 votes while his rival former defense minister, Todd Okano, got the remaining 170 votes. That after neither of the two managed to obtain a majority in an initial voting. The winner of the party poll is almost certain to become premier because of its majority in parliament's lower house Incumbent Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga is not seeking re-election after just 1 year in office. Suga's decision came after his government's approval rating sank below 30% as Japan struggles to deal with its worst case of COVID-19 infections. North Korea says the weapon it tested on Tuesday is a newly developed hypersonic missile. Pyongyang says the test confirmed navigational control and stability of the missile. North Korea is rapidly developing its missile technology. In a speech at the United Nations General Assembly, the North Korean envoy stressed that the weapons tests are within the country's right to self-defense. Pyongyang has long accused the U.S. and South Korea of pursuing a hostile policy against the North. Talks aimed at dismantling Pyongyang's nuclear and ballistic missile programs in return for U.S. sanctions relief collapsed in 2019. Joining us now from Uppsala, we have geopolitical analyst Greg Simons. Mr. Simons, welcome to the program. Let's jump right in. First of all, give us your thoughts on this recent weapon test by the North.
Well, it's signaling two things. That firstly, this so-called maximum pressure of the US to force an unfavorable agreement with the North Koreans is not going to work. And secondly, the idea that they would leave themselves defenseless, such as Iraq, Libya, and other countries, increases the risk of external attack. So that this is also, as I say, a means of self-preservation and protection.
What kind of a response are you expecting to see at this point from the likes of Washington?
Well, I don't think it could be anything too innovative. The U.S. will probably just reiterate the same talking points that they've been doing lately, that this is somehow a breach of trust or breaching international norms and laws and things like this. But, I mean, this is coming from the same country that has been regularly tearing up such treaties with other countries such as Russia. So, I mean, the US has very little credibility on the international stage at the moment, and they are obviously in decline, which is why North Korea is pursuing this particular policy.
And one last question. In your opinion, what are the prospects and the likelihood of getting any closer to peace on the Korean Peninsula?
I don't think there is, because of the reasons I just stated, that the U.S. is going to try its same tactics that it's used and failed in the past, even under Donald Trump. The same trying to be friendly is not going to be an option. So they've just got this maximum pressure, like they're trying to do to Iran, China, Russia, Cuba. It's going to be a continuation of the same failed policy. The U.S. is a declining hegemon, and the world is beginning to know it, which is why this is unlikely to create any kind of understandings or agreements in the end.
All right, thanks a lot. Greg Simons joining us from Uppsala. Moving on, thousands of internally displaced Afghans have no access to health care services, water, or enough food. This comes as the U.S. Move to freeze Kabul's assets has worsened the economic crisis in Afghanistan. As official figures show, over 3.5 million Afghans have been driven from their homes since the beginning of 2020, are in need of urgent humanitarian aid.
Some major international humanitarian agencies are warning about the consequences of the economic crisis in Afghanistan due to widespread joblessness, poverty, and U.S. sanctions on the country. Either war or unemployment has forced Hamid and hundreds of other families to flee their homes and get to Kabul in search of a better life. But contrary to their expectations, they are living here in this camp in northern Kabul for the internally displaced. They are living dire conditions and deprived of basic services.
We left our village in Baghlan province after the escalation of clashes back in July. Now we are living here while we have no access to our basic needs, such as portable water, electricity, or healthcare services. Hundreds of people here are suffering from malnutrition as well.
Abdullah is another internally displaced man who also lives here with his family members. He says nor the Taliban, neither humanitarian aid agencies have so far met their needs.
Ladies and gentlemen, news we had earlier, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has appointed Dr. Peyman Javedi as the new director of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting. Let's listen to the latest comments from Mr. Javedi.
One of our plans is to make our TV and radio coverage to the higher levels. It is high already, but it should be changed into a complete coverage. One of your guidelines of the IRIB is to implement the second phase of the Islamic Revolution. What are your plans? This is the first change in IRIB after the issuance of the second phase of the Islamic Revolution. Our slogan in this phase is to step in order to realize the new Islamic civilization. This is what the second phase of the Islamic Revolution focuses on, meaning that we have to make the borders of our audience beyond the borders of Iranian audience. We create programs for Iranian viewers, but we also look at foreign viewers. And our slogan is focused on the focal point of the second phase of the Islamic Revolution, which is to realize Islamic civilization. What are your plans in order to strengthen our world service programs? If our slogans in this phase, which is the second 40-year term of the Islamic Revolution, if we say that our discourse is trying to realize the new Islamic civilization, we have to expand our view beyond the borders of Iran. Our international view is not something not real. We are looking at the capacities of all nations. If we make synergy, we can reach a global capacity, and the role of our foreign, our world service channels is very important in this phase, and one of our plans is to strengthen our world service TV channels.
Well, those were the latest comments coming from Dr. Peyman Javedi, as we've been covering for you. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has appointed Mr. Javedi as the new director of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
Brioni Worthington, founder and board member of the new not-for-profit Climate Action Group, said, "By sharing and channeling data, we can maximize our efforts to combat carbon emissions and global warming. In other words, data is going to be the new water." We're prepared for you an article written by Robin McKee. The piece is titled, "How Data Could Save Earth from Climate Change." SUBEC may seem an odd choice for a new organization that aims to accelerate high-tech efforts to combat climate crisis. The name is Indonesian, it transpires, and refers to an ancient agricultural system that allows farmers to coordinate their efforts when irrigating and growing crops. Brioni Worthington, founder and board member of the new not-for-profit Climate Action Group, said, "SUBEC allows farmers to carefully synchronize their use of water and so maximize rice production." She added, "And that is exactly what we're going to do with data. By sharing and channeling data, we can maximize our efforts to combat carbon emissions and global warming. In other words, data is going to be the new water." SUBEC will be officially launched in the coming days and will select and fund non-profit groups working around the world to combat the climate crisis. Early startups already helped by SUBEC include one group that is assisting UK local authorities to boost electric car use, while another group is using accurate weather forecasts to make best use of solar power across Britain and limit fossil fuel burning to generate electricity. These efforts are being launched after a week of headlines that have highlighted how perilous life on Earth is becoming as global heating grips the planet. Floods in Germany and Belgium left more than 150 people dead. Scientists revealed that the Brazilian rainforest now emits more carbon dioxide than it absorbs. And wildfires devastated vast tracts of Californian forests. In each case, scientists warned that rising temperatures triggered by increasing levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere are likely to have played a key role in bringing about these catastrophes. Brioni Worthington, a noted climate activist and lead author of the team which drafted the UK's 2008 Climate Change Act, legislation that required the UK to reduce its carbon emissions by at least 80% of their 1990 levels, says urgent action is clearly needed. At the time, Worthington was working with Friends of the Earth, but was seconded to government to help design the legislation. For her efforts, she was made a peer in 2010. Since then, Brioni Worthington has continued in the battle against the climate crisis, and in 2019 she read Harvard academic Shoshana Zuboff's book The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, which focuses, disapprovingly, on high-tech companies' growing use of personal data to make money. Brioni Worthington says, "It woke me up to the fact that a whole new world of digital tools was being deployed to generate profits." She added, "I realized it would be better if those tools could be used to save the planet, to protect the global commons, and not merely to boost share value." Worthington contacted G. Fernando, a technology entrepreneur, and the pair hatched the idea of SUBEC, which has since been given funding by the Quadrature Climate Foundation, QCF, that was recently set up by the London investment management company, Quadrature Capital. Its aim is to provide initial funding to help groups establish themselves, but also to give expert guidance over legal management and other issues. G. Fernando says, when you start up a company or group, you are quite alone, adding, so if you have a community around you that can offer help, human resources, finance, tools, that is incredibly helpful. And then, once the group gets on their feet, they can then start to help other startup entrepreneurs wanting to open new avenues in order to help fight climate change. Fernando's words are echoed by several of the groups that SUBAC has already helped to set up, such as Open Climate Fix. This aims to reduce carbon emissions by improving weather forecasts to make the best use of solar power plants, whose effectiveness is reduced when the weather is cloudy. Open Climate Fix's co-founder Jack Kelly said, if we get very good data about forthcoming cloud cover, we will know exactly how much solar-generated electricity can be provided in the United Kingdom on a given day. Adding, that will mean we will not need to generate unnecessary electricity from other sources, in particular fossil fuel sources, such as gas, because we have underestimated the solar power we will get that day. That will help to reduce carbon emissions. Jack Kelly added, SUBAC's provision of engineers and software experts who have turned weather satellite images into cloud cover forecasts was a critical piece of assistance. A similar tale is told by Richard Allen of New Automotive, which is monitoring new electric cars are being taken up in communities across the United Kingdom. Factors include vehicle use, sales patterns and favorite types of cars and trucks. That data can be fed to local authorities to ensure charging stations, battery replacement services, and other resources are provided to maximize take-up of electric cars. Richard Allen says, replacing petrol and diesel vehicles with electric versions as quickly as possible is going to be extremely important in reducing carbon emissions. He adds, and data about take-up rates in communities will be vital in achieving that goal. This view is endorsed by Brioni Worthington. She says, just a major corporation has lots of different companies under its control. SUBAC is going to help set up lots of new outfits, each aimed at boosting efforts to control climate change. Climate crisis in numbers, 415. The number of parts per million of carbon dioxide that make up the atmosphere. Before the Industrial Revolution in the mid-1700s, the global average amount of carbon dioxide was about 280 parts per million. Burning fossil fuels has since added a further 135 parts per million. And if global energy demand continues to grow and is met mostly with fossil fuels, that figure could exceed 900 parts per million by 2100. 3.6 millimeter, the estimated increase each year in sea level, according to measurements of tide gauges and satellite data. This is a result of human-induced warming of the planet. It is projected that the sea level will rise a further 40 to 80 centimeters by 2100, although future ice sheets melt could make these values considerably higher. 43.1 billion. In 2019, that was the number of tons of carbon dioxide from human activities that were emitted into the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, that absorbs heat and releases it gradually over time, like bricks in a fireplace after the fire goes out. Current increases in greenhouse gases has tipped the Earth's energy budget out of balance, trapping additional heat and raising Earth's average temperature. 28 trillion, the estimated number of tons of ice that our planet has lost between 1994 and 2017. Global warming has a particularly severe impact at higher latitudes, and this has been most noticeable in the Arctic region. Scientists worry that as ice melts, less solar radiation will be reflected back into space, and temperatures will rise even faster. Ice loss will become increasingly severe as a result.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of instrumentation.
The Spotlight.
It's the fourth day of long lines and dry pumps in Britain, and the army's preparing to help with a fuel supply problem. The rise in demand came amid fears of a driver shortage hitting fuel supply. The UK is set to be short of 100,000 truck drivers, causing problems for food suppliers and supermarkets. Now, this is set to be the result of new Brexit visa regulations and also a COVID backlog. Now, let's go to London to our own Amina Terror, and let's hear her tell us about the situation there. I mean, over to you.
Well, unfortunately, it would have been another worrying day for consumers as they perhaps worried about how they might get to work, to school, and go about their daily lives tomorrow. Because despite Prime Minister Boris Johnson making his first on-camera comments about this, saying the situation was returning to some kind of satisfactory levels, and that consumers must go about their petrol filling business in the normal way in order to help regulate the supplies at the pumps. The Petrol Retailers Association, that's the main group who looks after four courts here, who represent those members, say still nearly 40% of their four courts are empty. Now, if you extrapolate from the information, even if you can find a place with a long line, you're actually in the minority here because a lot of the petrol pumps are running dry. When I filed my story on this yesterday, we drove to six places hoping to speak to people in those long lines, and there were none because the forecourts were empty. So Grant Shapps, the transport secretary here, has placed the blame firmly on hauliers, the haulage industry, and also on consumers for panic buying. But I think the messaging coming out of Downing Street and the government might not really be matching the reality on the ground as people see empty forecourts and, of course, long lines if they're lucky enough to see those. This is also very briefly turned into a political situation with Sir Keir Starmer, leader of the Labour Party, saying he would be handling things in a different way, prioritizing key workers and extending the visa program to ensure experienced HGV drivers from across the UK and EU can actually help alleviate the situation.
Okay, thank you for that. I'm Anna Taylor in London. Now, welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. In this edition, we're discussing the fuel crisis in the UK. To do that, I'll be joined by co-founder of the regional investment platform, Justin Urquhart-Stewart in London. and filmmaker and activist Ken Farrow, also in London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to the show. Let me start with Justin. A fourth day of long lines, Justin, as you heard, and pump closures as prices rise to eight-year highs. And there are instances of violence between angry customers and tensions as tensions are rising. How bad is the situation, in your opinion?
It's been really quite pathetic when you actually see what's happened and how it's been handled. But it does vary hugely across the country. There are some areas where I come across, I was in Northfield yesterday, and there were very little issues so much there. But other areas, no, it really has been dreadful. And of course, when people are desperate because they need their transport, maybe it's not just for their work, but for medical issues, all sorts of elements, if people cannot get it, and there are queues growing too long, or, as often you'll find with petrol stations, there are two entrances. So you end up immediately with an argument between two queues as to who's getting what. But that, as you were just, Amina was just saying, we've had a distinct lack of political leadership to try and manage our way out of this. This, after all, is nothing new. This was predicted over 18 months ago. And yet we find ourselves in a position where politicians are looking at some surprise, saying, we didn't think this was going to happen. Oh, yes, you did. You just you didn't prepare for it.
Right. Now, our second guest is also joining us, Ken Farrow, filmmaker and activist in London. Good to have you with us, Ken. Boris Johnson's government has announced a series of emergency measures to address the fuel crisis. So how is the fuel crisis being tackled?
Well, it's being tackled quite incompetently, but what we have to remember is that the crisis itself is not just around fuel, it's around the very infrastructure of the United Kingdom that relies on foreign workers, migrant workers, who were told to leave this country. And so I don't think this is just about fuel. This crisis is about the future of this country in terms of its workforce. It has a diminishing workforce, and this is just the first sign of many things to come. So whatever the government does or doesn't do in this situation, it really isn't going to make any difference in the long run until they address the very fundamental nature of work, workers' rights, the rights of workers who come to Britain. And so that has to be the solution. So the solutions in terms of the army and the small number of licenses being offered, and even those that are restricted, are just a smokescreen for the bigger issues here, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Now, Justin, how big a role does Brexit play in this fuel crisis besetting Britain?
I think in many ways it's almost a backdrop to the whole thing. There are many issues which have affected what's happened to this. The pandemic, the pingdemic, as we like to call it, because of the app we have on our phones, and also the level of concern because people have been off on furlough for so long. But Brexit is lurking behind it. Now, let's be fair, there are a shortage of drivers throughout the whole of Europe, very significant numbers indeed. It's almost a generational issue that people don't want to go back to working in really very poor quality in terms of pay and conditions for such a vital issue. What the pandemic brought out was how weak our supply chains were, not just coming from, say, the Far East and the difficulties there because of the pandemic, let alone from the odd ship getting stuck in the Suez Canal. But actually this issue with regard to domestic supply chains, and it's not just about fuel. There's no shortage of fuel at all, but actually making sure the structure is there to make sure food, essential items are being delivered on time. And people's expectations, of course, over the past few years, have said that they expect it there to be immediately. But this is what's so frustrating about what we've seen with this. Brexit has meant that a proportion of the workforce have gone back. And, of course, although the government has come up with a temporary scheme for 3 months, no person in their right mind is going to come back just for 3 months, and they'll probably be told to go home again just over the Christmas holiday period. And any politician who's seriously putting that forward as an answer to this is frankly deluded.
Now, Ken, how about COVID-19? You know, coronavirus backlog is also blamed for this fuel problem.
Well, I think the experience of COVID and the way the country fundamentally ground to a halt in terms of economic development acted as a buffer for the impacts of Brexit. Now that the country's coming out of COVID and that there's a much more economic activity, people need to start moving around. And so we're beginning to see the impact of the effects of Brexit with this so-called fuel distribution crisis. But also I think we're going to be seeing it in the future in terms of other areas as well. So what essentially happened in COVID is that the country fundamentally shut down to a greater extent. We had stops and starts over different periods, but it didn't really get on its feet in economic terms. And now that we are apparently coming out of COVID and that economic activity is increasing, we have this issue coming up. And I think it's going to the impact of COVID was to act as a buffer to the, bad planning, mismanagement, and basically foolish acts of the British government in terms of Brexit.
Okay, Justin, do you share the same view?
Yeah, and Brexit, if you just want a straightforward calculation, you're knocking about $2 billion value off the British economy. Now, billions are one of those numbers that you can't actually, most people don't get their head around. It's a lot of money. And at a time when the economy is supposed to be trying to recover, you've automatically taken away linkage to the largest trading bloc in the world. Now, this is what is so ridiculous. The largest trading bloc in the world, where Britain was not only a member of, but has significant influence as one of the major powers in it. So actually, this has made the EU significantly weaker as well, because Germany is desperate to reform the EU. But as their previous finance minister said, it's all very well trying to reform it, but they can't do that with Luxembourg and Denmark. They need someone with a big budget and political strength to see it through. So the impact also on the EU is there. But I have to say that the bad handling by our politicians with regard to Brexit, ending up with a populist vote for people voting to leave without really understanding the fundamental issues behind all of this.
Well, unfortunately, we lost the connection with Justin. Let me ask you this. Labour has said that the latest response to the fuel crisis is an admission of failure and that asking the army to pitch in is a sticking plaster. Do you have the same opinion?
In a sense, I do. I mean, clearly, it's not a solution to distribution. And, the British government and the army could very, very quickly solve this situation in terms of physical distribution. But I think what's at stake here, there are two issues that we really need to talk about in relation to your question. One is that Labour have consistently failed the rights of migrant workers. And migrant workers are the very group of people who sustain the infrastructure of the country, whether it's to do with food, whether it's to do with transport, whether it's to do with the National Health Service. So they're a very, very important part of that workforce. And of course, Labour have done nothing to support those groups. And even looking at the party conference at the moment, they're doing very little to actually move forward in terms of that. But I think what we're discussing here is basically, we have a capitalist system which has seen a hiccup. But at the same time, out of every crisis, just as we had the kind of corruption that we witnessed with politicians in Britain in terms of providing jobs and contracts to their friends who exploited the situation in terms of COVID, in terms of PPE, and the supply of medical, we're seeing the same things going on now in terms of the petroleum companies who will benefit from this situation. So I think there's a bigger picture here in terms of just discussing about how do we get the country running again? Well, right. What country do we want to have running again? So I think these are important questions.
Okay, Justin, sorry for that technical problem. We lost our connection for a few seconds. Go ahead with your comments.
Yes, so the issue is one of what you find yourself with, actually losing your connection with the largest trading bloc in the world, is frankly stupid. Because the wealth that actually Britain has acquired since joining the EU was huge. And none of that was properly discussed at the time of the vote. But Britain has benefited when it joined the what was the EEC in those days. It was the poor man of Europe. When we left, we weren't necessarily the richest, but certainly one of the wealthiest, really seemed to be quite a successful economy, despite many difficult issues and longer-term elements, which Phil has just highlighted there, which weren't being properly addressed in terms of not just low pay, but actually the ability to make sure you've got immigrants coming to work here. Because after all, remember, Britain is an immigrant country. Actually, the entire country is made up of waves upon it, and our success has always been our acceptance of and taking in those people. And we're going to see a lot more of that over the next few years. Bear in mind, we've probably got 300,000 people potentially coming from Hong Kong, which I think will be extremely exciting for Britain. But for the reaction of our politicians, I fear they are far more old-fashioned in their attitudes and more Luddite in their behaviour, rather than seeing the economic possibilities that this could create.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ken, do you believe that the measures the British government has taken are sufficient to tackle the issue? You know, there are some measures like temporarily exempting fuel companies from competition law.
Well, I think out of every crisis, whether it's man-made or whether it's natural, you know, there are elements within the government and within society that exploit that situation. So I think that there's money being made at the moment out of this crisis, and we can see that just on a basic level in terms of people kind of stocking up on fuel and doing a run on fuel, which now becomes more demanding, more in demand and more expensive, right to the top where you have these companies who have no who are basically told that, well, you can make as much money as you want to at the moment. So I think all of that is going on. I mean, essentially, that we have a capitalist country. We're talking about how to get it running again. And this is not really the most significant issue here. The most significant issue is the mistreatment of working class people, the mistreatment of immigrants and migrants. And ironically, at the very same time, you know, we had people from the Caribbean, from Jamaica, coming over, invited after the war to work in the NHS on the buses. And there was the Windrush scandal where some of them were asked to return after decades and decades of being settled in the UK. And the ironic thing is, at the moment, the British government is actually out in Jamaica trying to recruit nurses for the shortfall that we have in the National Health Service. So the crisis on fuel is really part of a much bigger crisis this country is experiencing. And it's something that can only be solved if Britain becomes less insular and if the people of Britain accept the fact that the reality of the situation is that politically, culturally, economically, Britain is part of the world, it's international, and it needs to behave like that, instead of shrinking in and trying to become an island fortress.
Mm-hmm. Justin, let's have your comment on that.
Well, you only have to look back at the history of Britain. We may not necessarily be very proud of colonial periods and things like that, but Britain's been its most successful when it has seen itself as an international country operating internationally, whether that's today in modern financial services and things like that, which of course have been hit by Brexit as well, or in terms of trade, but also in terms of accepting in waves of immigrants who really benefited the economy. Whether you're going back to the periods of the pogroms of Russia at the turn of the 20th century, or whether you're dealing with people coming from Armenes, Uganda, you're seeing people who come here and come into society have added astonishing value to it, not just in terms of economic issues, but also in terms of its culture as well. Unfortunately, you then have, it's very easy to whip up, as it were, protectionist, isolationist views, as you saw with President Trump, to be able to say, put America first. Well, actually, no, that's ridiculous. It's much better when a country like Britain realizes it's an international player, that's what it's always done, and it is at most successful when it is at most open to other people, accepting of their cultures, and being able to actually help the economy. And so we're being very short-sighted, unfortunately, if we're just going to bow and let populist politicians get away with it. That's stupid.
Ken, as you know, the average age of drivers in Britain is 55 years old, and they're retiring, and the industry hasn't made that job attractive either. And the UK needs 100,000 truck drivers. So what's the solution?
Well, the solution is not around 100,000. It's not about average age. None of those issues are as important as the fundamental rights of working class people in this country. So whilst any measures the government puts in or the industry suggests are necessary for them to be able to maintain their distribution, maintain their profit making, really the fundamental questions that should come out of this, people should be asking, you know, what kind of country does Britain want to be? How do people want to live? What kind of society do they want? And what do they want to get out of it beyond the selfishness that we've seen, you know, even in terms of the panic buying over the past 3 or 4 days or week. Essentially, you know, every crisis, as Naomi Klein outlined, you know, has the benefit of some people. There will be always people that benefit from the crisis. So there was no need for this so-called fuel crisis. In fact, it's not even a crisis. You know, it's just an opportunity for the government to reassert its control. And even though they may appear to be, you know, incompetent and stupid and ineffective, they don't really care. The government is making money out of the situation. The government made money out of COVID, and it will continue to make money. People have to remember that this government was voted in and has behaved intolerably since it took power. It's only interested in a very narrow group of people. It's interested in itself out of making money. There's no commitment to community. There's no commitment to the people. And so for people to be asking the government, the very people who have really abused the country since they took power, is, I think, laughable. And I think people should really not think just beyond filling their petrol up in their car, but really what to do beyond that.
Right. Justin, what's the main part of the problem? Is the driver shortage the main part of the problem or what?
No, it's not. What you've actually got is a huge fragility in terms of the supply system. And where you, as you saw the pandemic, the supply structures were very, very weak indeed. So, you know, people were talking about the impact on holiday presents and such like over a year ago. And this was really before anything to do with truck drivers or anything like that. And bear in mind, the truck drivers issue isn't just a British issue. You've got the same happening throughout Poland and Germany and other elements. Huge numbers shorting. People have not come back to that work. Why? Well, primarily because over the past two decades, you've had people being able to develop the gig economy. That's to say, you are paid immediately for what you do by the hour with very little social responsibility to your position and how your rights are respected. That is now changing. And those drivers are staying, or those obviously retiring, people not going into this part of the industry because it's not paid well enough. Their services are thwarting it are very incredibly weak. So why should they bother? There are other things they can go and do. And of course they can now do that because there are less people around to work because an awful lot have gone back to the rest of Europe, and there is now a, you know, a huge demand. It's not just lorries, but also just look at, say, the service and leisure sector. If I go to a restaurant or a pub or something like that, it is immediately noticeable that you have probably have lost probably 25 to 30% of people who would normally be working there. Because they're not available, they've gone back to Europe, or they turn around and said, I'm not prepared to work, frankly, these tiny pay levels, and therefore there are other things I can go and do, because there are lots of other jobs that will be available, and give them more. So the economy has to change. This is an inflection point, not just in Britain, but also actually in certain areas throughout the rest of Europe as well.
Okay, and that note will come to end this edition of the Spotlight. Let me thank our guests. We had co-founder of the regional investment platform, Justin Urquhart-Stewart, and filmmaker and activist Ken Ferrer, both of them in London. I've been your host, Behruz Najafian. I'll see you next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره، همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.